Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has 6 causes consolidated into 4 arguments on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Harold C. Peeler versus Hughes and Luce and Darrell C. Jordan from Dallas County. And Health Trust Incorporated and others versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell, Judge, and original mandamus proceeding consolidated for oral argument with St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company and Leah Dalmolin versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell, Judge, original mandamus proceeding, and Health Trust Incorporated and others versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell, Judge. The third matter will be Don Bradbury versus Central Power and Light Company from Hidalgo County. And finally, I am Werner, trustee for East Tex Meat Processing Incorporated, Employee Benefit Trust, and others versus Dixie A. Colwell from Leon County. In each of these 4 arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we will complete all 4 arguments before the lunch break. We'll have a late lunch break this morning. Justice Gonzalez has voluntarily recused from the first matter, but he will be present for the final 3 arguments and will participate in the deliberations and decision of those causes. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. We are now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Peeler versus Hughes and Luce.
May it please the court, Mr. Waldo will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. This case began in Dallas County when Carol Peeler was sued by Hughes and Luce and Darrell Jordan for an unpaid portion of attorney's fees. This case began with Carol Peeler as a defendant when her attorneys brought a lawsuit against her to recover an additional $60,000 from approximately $400,000 that had previously been paid to them for their representation of Mrs. Peeler. In 1982, Carol Peeler was an officer in Hillcrest Securities and Equities. This was a concern that had to do with the trading of government securities for tax shelters for investors. In January of 1983, Congress passed the Technical Corrections Act that related back to 2 days before these transactions occurred. In 1984, Hillcrest came under investigation by the Internal Revenue Service because of deductions that had been taken by some of their investors on their tax returns. And in 1984, the Corporate Counsel for Hillcrest suggested to Carol Peeler and other officers within both of these concerns that they be represented by individual counsel because of a potential conflict of interest he had in representing the corporation and them as individuals. She was then referred to Hughes and Luce, and specifically to Mr. Darrell Jordan, because of the potential conflict that existed. In 1984 and 1985, the federal government, through the Internal Revenue Service, felt it was on to a massive tax scheme because, principally, of some things that had happened in New York involving a fellow by the name of Edward Markowitz. They thought that Hillcrest was involved in that tax scheme. They thought that what was going on is that bonds and government securities were being added to tax returns as tax deductions, and these securities were not actually being purchased. That, in fact, never occurred. That investigation never bore fruition for any of the investigations that were being made against Carol Peeler and her partners at Hillcrest. But in December of 1985, while that investigation was going on, the assistant U.S. attorney in Dallas, Mr. Bill Alexander, called Carol Peeler's attorney, Darrell Jordan. And during that conversation, according to his sworn testimony, which is part of the record, he made a definite, unambiguous offer of complete transactional immunity, as he described it, from the beginning of the world to the end of time for Carol Peeler. That offer was never passed on to her. She never knew of that offer of immunity. During the continued representation of Carol Feeler, there was a memo surfaced, and it surfaced right after the immunity offer was made, and it's also part of the record. And in that memo, two associate attorneys, Hughes and Luce, warned Daryl Jordan that the risk we are taking in not obtaining immunity for Carol Feeler is that, one, that the U.S. Attorney's Office will find another crack in the dike, that they will give immunity to someone else, and two, even though we don't feel that she has violated any statutes and we don't feel that she is guilty of what the investigation is about, that this is a highly technical and highly regulated area. It's entirely conceivable that during the investigation, there will be violations that we don't know about now, that Carol may have been involved in, that she will ultimately be prosecuted for. Both of those foreseen risks occur. After the immunity offer was not passed on to Carol and when it was not responded to, then the assistant U.S. attorney went to Mr. Buzz Tompkins and gave him immunity.
And he was given Hughes and Luce represented several officers in this.
Hughes and Luce represented Carol Feeler, and at the same time they were representing Alexander Grant, who was the CPA firm for Hillcrest that was involved in these transactions also. But Carol Feeler was the only officer. And after Buzz Tompkins was given the immunity in March of 1986, the investigation continued based on information that they had received, the U.S. Attorney's Office had received from Mr. Tompkins. It resulted in indictments against Carol Feeler, her husband, and several other of the officers of Hillcrest in 1989 for a violation of the Technical Corrections Act of January of 1993, which related back to 2 days before the purchases were made in September of 82.
She pled guilty to one of those charges, did she not?
Yes, sir. She did.
You state in your brief, Carol Feeler was and is innocent of these charges. And your opposing counsel on page 4 of his brief excerpts portions of her deposition where she concedes her guilt. How do you reconcile your representation with her deposition testimony?
Your Honor, the reference in our brief to her being guilty of the charges has to do with the initial charges that were being investigated back in 1984 and 1985.
You don't contend that she was innocent of the charges which she pled guilty to at this time?
We certainly concede that she is judicially estopped at this point because of her plea in 1989. The reference in the brief has to do with the initial charges that were being investigated in 1985. For which she was offered complete transactional immunity that would have included everything.
I'm sorry. Are you saying that she was not found guilty of any of the charges for which she now claims she should have been given immunity for?
The charges or the investigation centered around certain activities where the government thought there was a massive fraud bond scheme going on. That none of those charges ever resulted in indictments.
Maybe I've misunderstood. The crime for which she ultimately pled guilty was not the crime for which she claims she should have been given immunity for?
No, sir. The crime she ultimately pled guilty to in 1989 was not contemplated by nor being investigated by anyone in 1985 when the immunity offer was made. But it arose out of all of these transactions. The immunity offer in 1985 would have covered the crime that she ultimately pled guilty to in 1989.
All right. Thank you.
After her guilty plea, she was contacted by a reporter of the D Magazine in Dallas and for the first time learned of the immunity offer. That's the first time she had ever heard of it. After that happened, she confronted her attorney, and her attorney denied it. After that happened, according to the sworn testimony of the assistant U.S. attorney, Bill Alexander, her attorney, Daryl Jordan, made an unannounced visit into Bill Alexander's office and tried to convince the assistant U.S. attorney that the immunity offer had never been made and suggested to him that, well, we had discussed in very general terms immunity, but an offer had never been made. And in his deposition testimony, Mr. Alexander said, quote, I told him, Daryl, I know what I said, and I'm sticking to it, and I made a direct offer to you. And that's the position. Now, she
when
brings...
When was this memo generated, this internal memo at the law firm?
The internal memo was generated in January of 1986, Your Honor.
The offer was made when?
The offer was made in December of 1985 by a telephone call from the assistant U.S. attorney to Mr. Jordan.
So, and then Jordan had a memo addressed to him by two other members of the firm, was it?
Yes, sir.
They knew about it, at least at that time, is that correct?
Well, the memo doesn't discuss an immunity offer. It discusses immunity. It doesn't discuss specifically the telephone conversation between the assistant U.S. attorney and the senior partner in the firm to whom the memo is addressed. But it speaks about immunity, and it speaks about trying to take advantage of immunity, or we run these two risks. Someone else will get it, or there will be a technical violation we're unaware of right now, that she may be indicted, both of which occur.
Mr. Wallner, the trial court granted summary judgment in this case.
Yes, sir.
And at least from the summary judgment evidence, you have conflicting statements as to whether or not the offer of immunity was made. So there's a fact issue there if that's relevant to our inquiry. But the trial court granted summary judgment on the basis that the sole cause of her injury was her pleading guilty to this crime. Her deposition says that she concedes that she was guilty of the crime for which she pled guilty. It seems to me that's the pertinent issue here. How do you get beyond what this court's jurisprudence has been in the past about some attorney being liable for a defendant who's otherwise guilty of the crime that they pled to?
To begin with, Your Honor, we feel this is a case of first impression that hasn't been written on by this court with regard to whether or not an innocence requirement is established to maintain a legal malpractice claim against a criminal defense attorney. That we feel that the authorities in this state, and the ones that we've cited in our brief, identify specifically that a legal malpractice claim against a criminal defense attorney is no different than one against a civil attorney. A duty, a breach of the duty, proximate cause of damages.
In Texas, we bifurcate the liability and the punishment phases of criminal trials, the guilt, innocence, and the punishment phases.
Yes, sir.
Would your argument be that in such a trial, if a defendant were found guilty by a jury and then a sentence was imposed either by the jury or the judge, that the defendant could claim malpractice on the part of counsel in misrepresenting him or her during the punishment phase?
Yes, sir. Can claim
if you failed to put on a witness or you didn't do it the right way, or some claim would be, I got 20 years and I only should have got 10 if you put this on.
In the cases that have been submitted by both sides, Your Honor, show that there's a division in the jurisdictions. On one hand, there are jurisdictions that hold that conviction, unless it's ever set aside, will bar a legal malpractice claim against the criminal defendant. There are other jurisdictions, like the cases in Ohio and Virginia and Alabama that we cited to the court, that hold that if you can show the existence of a duty, the breach of the duty, negligence, and proximate cause, then you maintain a standing as a plaintiff in a civil action under those circumstances.
Do you think there would be a lot of cases where criminal defendants claim that they would have gotten a lesser sentence if their lawyer hadn't messed up the punishment phase of the trial?
If I may answer that two ways. First of all, with regard to these specific facts, we have been unable, and when I say we, with all due respect, I'm talking about both sides, have been unable to find any case in any jurisdiction in this country where there was an immunity offer made, a plea and bar on the criminal side that would have absolutely, totally done away with any risk whatsoever to the client and was never passed on to the client. To the contrary, all the cases have to do with inadvertence. You didn't call a witness. You didn't file a certain motion or pleading and things of that nature. You know, having to do with the judgment of the attorney. That's not what this case is about. This case is about a criminal defense lawyer who had in his pocket the Rosetta Stone, the ultimate for his client, while she was being investigated that would have foreclosed any a prosecution on any of these transactions.
Well, then do you propose that the rule in this case be limited to situations where there is an intentional refusal to pass on an immunity offer, or is it broad enough to encompass the circumstances I described, any punishment here?
I feel that the rule in this case should be that the innocence requirement for a defendant in criminal prosecution, when they have not been represented properly by their attorney, when their attorney has been negligent, should be the same as it is for attorneys who represent other clients in other matters.
I thought that was your answer earlier, so coming back to my question then, even though there may be few cases involving offers of immunity, how many do you think there would be if the rule allowed any criminal defendant who was convicted to claim that he was misrepresented during the punishment phase of the trial?
Well, according to the Tiarena versus Winnemar case that we've cited out of Corpus Christi, that essentially is how many of the courts of appeals are interpreting the law in the state of Texas as it is now.
So you don't think there'd be any more or less than there are now?
I don't think there would be any more. Alternatively, a more restrictive rule for Carol Peeler would be that when a criminal defense attorney is presented with what would be an absolute bar to prosecution, and he or she fails to advise the client of that or otherwise take advantage of it, that there should maintain a civil cause of action for the damages that result from it.
And let me be sure, one more question. This would apply in plea bargains too, I take it, where the defendant pleads out to some lesser sentence or a lesser offense than the prosecutor is prepared to charge. I guess you could argue under those circumstances that if counsel had not been negligent, I would have gotten even a better deal than I got.
Yes, sir, and that was exactly the case in Wright versus Lewis that involved a podiatrist that was charged with Medicare fraud. He went to trial, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to prison time. He found out later in one of the pre-sentencing hearings from the prosecutor, the assistant U.S. attorney, that he had had discussions about reducing the charge to a misdemeanor for a plea, and that was the subject of that case. That court held that the possibility of a better deal was not good enough, just the possibility. In this case, it's much more than the possibility. It's the absolute certainty based on the assistant U.S. attorney, the two federal investigators who heard it, that have given sworn testimony, the SEC prosecutor who had the conversation with Mr. Jordan in the airport, and Mr. Jordan acknowledged to him about the plea bargain, about the immunity offer, and the reporter from Dallas, who also in her notes had the same acknowledgement from Mr. Jordan, that there was an offer of transactional complete immunity made. It was never passed on. Had it been passed on as is required under a code of professional responsibility, that would have ended it. There never would have been any prosecution. There never would have been a plea that she was advised to plead guilty to by the same attorney who did not pass on the immunity offer to her.
Do you think that the case within a case burden in a civil malpractice setting should apply in the criminal setting? That is, do you think it should be the burden of the criminal defendant to show that but for the criminal defense lawyer's malpractice, they would have been found not guilty?
I think to an extent. I think, Your Honor, that what should happen in a legal malpractice case against a criminal defense attorney is what they allege in their trial pleadings. They've alleged as an affirmative defense. We ask the trier of fact to reduce any award to Carol Peeler by the percentage responsibility she has because of her own conduct. And that, if it
exceeds...
You mean
her criminal conduct?
Yeah, any of her conduct that gave rise to her damages.
So they ought to compare the negligence of the criminal defense lawyer to the criminal conduct of the criminal defendant.
Yes, sir. And in the Tiarena case, Mr. Tiarena had two previous felony convictions. This is his third one, the habitual criminal offense. This was his third one. In that case, and that was a pro se case, all the way up through appeal. But if it hadn't been kicked out on the summary judgment, if he had gone to trial, that jury would have heard that the damages to this man for a third conviction, that this man who has two prior felony convictions, and then they would look at the conduct that gave rise to the third one to determine, as they pled in the trial court, his percentage of responsibility. If it exceeds 50%, then there's no compensation of any type given.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Governor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Margaret Sloan, representing Arkansas
Justice Phillips, and may it please the court. It's important in considering this case to return to a proper perspective of the rather simple facts that are involved in the legal issues that are actually before the court here. On the one hand is the plaintiff who pleaded guilty to and freely admits that she was guilty of the crime of tax fraud. Those are facts that absolutely must be taken as true in considering this case. It was no mere technicality, Your Honors. I invite the court to read the indictment. It's in volume one of the transcript at page 30, in which she's charged with participation in 20 of 21 counts of a tax fraud conspiracy and admitted on her deposition in this case that she was guilty of. The plaintiff, the petitioner here, is seeking money damages for being indicted, convicted, and punished for tax fraud. On the other hand,
is that what she's seeking damages for?
Yes, sir.
Or is she seeking damages for the lack of a lawyer that she paid for?
Her injuries, Your Honor, were the prosecution and conviction and punishment for tax fraud.
And whatever she paid her lawyer.
Ms. Peeler.
She operated without legal representation.
Your Honor,
before you argue with the other side.
She had a claim, which was a perfectly appropriate claim, for return of her fees. And she abandoned that. That's not present any longer in the case.
Why was that claim perfectly appropriate?
Well, I mean, it was appropriate to assert it. I'm not saying it was well taken, Your Honor.
Is there a different legal standard for return of fees than for damages?
Well, I think so. The injury for a breach of contract claim would be that she paid to have effective representation and allegedly did not receive representation that met a professional standard, a breach of contract.
For this, I want to be sure I've got my facts straight. She paid $250,000 non-refundable fee, an additional hourly fee, to the tune she paid a total of $400,000, and then the firm sued her for an additional $60,000 after they failed to disclose to her an offer of immunity and advised her to plead guilty?
Well, they allege, and the defendants vehemently deny, that they failed to communicate a meaningful opportunity for immunity, Justice Gamage. That's a fact question. But I think that the court, in considering the legal issues here, takes those facts as true.
Are you suggesting
takes those facts also as true?
Are you suggesting that we follow or pursue or adopt a rule of law that leaves a lawyer impervious to any recourse for this type of behavior and malpractice, I would presume, towards a client, if indeed it's true?
Absolutely not, Justice Gamage.
What recourse does an accused client have?
Well, first, a claim for return of the fees. Secondly, there are grievance procedures that can result not in compensation to the plaintiff for the injuries suffered by virtue of having committed a crime and been indicted, prosecuted, convicted, and punished for it. But those grievance procedures do not leave a lawyer immune. They can result in disbarment, which to my mind is a much more serious thing than making an award of money that may not even come out of the lawyer's own pocket. But the question for this court, Your Honor, is whether the plaintiff is to be compensated for those injuries when the plaintiff is an admittedly guilty criminal and set in motion the processes that resulted in her injuries. The lawyer would not be exempt.
In a civil proceeding where the defendant has been sued perhaps for slander and exemplary damages, and an offer is communicated that in return for an apology, the plaintiff will drop the suit. Now, in that instance, you have the same problem. There may have been slander. I mean, it may have been... there's a possibility that a jury would impose punitive damages. Wouldn't an attorney have an obligation to tell the client of that offer?
Well, Your Honor, that certainly is not the case before the court, where you have a person here who brought all this on, including her injuries, herself.
Well, how is that any different from a defendant who's accused of,
of defamation?
Allegedly has committed a tort?
Well, I think it's a world of difference in that the public policy of this state and of the 11 of the dozen jurisdictions elsewhere in America that have considered this is that when you commit a crime, then you will not be heard to be compensated or indemnified in any way for the necessary and inevitable consequences of that crime.
And you're not entitled to legal representation in that.
Oh, of course you're entitled to representation, Justice Spector. But it's not, the question is not the representation that was given, but the character and the nature of what the plaintiff is complaining about. And that's what this very sound and universal policy is based on. Now, I'd like to refer to...
Just one brief line of question. Let us suppose that Mr. Jordan's client had not decided to plea bargain, but had gone through with a trial and at great length, great trial, go on appeal, whatever, but at any rate, eventually was found not guilty of any crime, and then later learned from a reporter or somewhere that there was allegedly this communication of transactional immunity that she did not hear about. Would she then have a cause of action for malpractice?
Assuming that she could establish her innocence, yes.
Well, that's already been established. I mean, she'd have to establish it again.
Well, fair enough. I think that there might be a distinction. I certainly don't urge
she'd have to prove by she'd have to prove by preponderance of evidence that she was not guilty rather than whatever.
Well,
that's not really as important to me as the question of whether, if that's the law, that is absolute immunity if your client's eventually found guilty and if your client eventually is not guilty, at least possibility through some legal standard of legal malpractice, does this put any conflicting incentives on an attorney in a criminal case who has, through the course of the representation, committed some act that a court and jury may later find to be malpractice? In other words, under your rule, once the criminal attorney makes a mistake that may rise to the level of malpractice, the incentive to get the client off might be conflicted.
Well, certainly I don't see the conflict, Justice Phillips. I'm sorry, I guess I'm not following your question.
Well, I didn't articulate it very well, but I mean, I can put it in. If Mr. Jordan had it came to light in the middle of his representation that his client believed that she had had such an opportunity for transactional immunity, and through her attorney's negligence, she had missed it. Okay. Then, under the rule you propose, if they went to trial and he did a vigorous job of representing her and put her, but went through the agony of a trial, he might be exposed to personal civil liability, whereas if he didn't do such a good job, he would not be. Well, now, does that create a problem?
I see. I don't think so, Your Honor. The record would be there if there were some other complaint like that. That could be made the object of the criminal defendant's action. The issue here, though, is the character of the plaintiff's wrong and the nature of the plaintiff's wrong and the character of her injuries.
Are we really talking about her wrong? Or are we not talking about the wrong that her attorney committed?
Well,
which is a completely different matter.
Yes, Justice Hightower, but I think that the policy on the one hand of American jurisdictions, including Texas, that a criminal plaintiff, an admittedly criminal plaintiff, cannot be compensated in any way where the criminal conduct that that person set in motion is results in what inevitably results, i.e., prosecution, conviction, and punishment.
But our whole
and that you will not reward that person. Now,
our whole jurisprudence, counsel, criminal jurisprudence, is dedicated to seeing that the person charged gets the full benefit of the law. A criminal defendant is entitled to the full benefit of the law. Are we saying that they're entitled to less?
Well, I don't say that they're entitled to less, but I say that if they seek damages.
But then if they do not get the kind of representation against them, the full benefit of the law that they're entitled to, aren't they damaged?
They're not damaged, Your Honor, by that. They're damaged by the inevitable consequences that they undertake when they commit a crime.
Then they'd be just as well off not to have an attorney.
No, I don't say that, Your Honor. Of course, I don't say that.
I'm having some real difficulty wrestling with the concept that the law would grant immunity from liability to the client, the lawyer that purposefully failed to transmit an offer of immunity to the client. I have real difficulty accepting that concept. The circumstances of this case are not ordinary circumstances. In the criminal law, the popular and the vernacular, a term called dumping in the grease. Usually a lawyer dumps his client in the grease when the client misbehaves in his relationship with the lawyer, lies to the lawyer, or other things. It's the first case I've ever encountered where a lawyer got well paid to dump his client in the grease and then is immune for his own dishonesty.
Well, in our brief are numerous cases that deal with this policy question and legal causation question, Justice Gingrich. But let me address your question that you say you have difficulty with, immunity in this case. Given that that policy is the policy of Texas and is the policy of virtually every civilized jurisdiction in the world, starting with that viewpoint, Justice Gingrich, a criminal does not have any right to get off or an inherent right to receive immunity immunity is a necessary evil.
I understand, but as a matter of policy, we accept the concept of immunity in order to grease the wheels of justice, if you will, the prosecution of other offenders.
We accept it for the benefit of prosecutors who are able to take guilty people when they have no other avenue or witnesses, grant them immunity in order to prosecute the crime. But immunity is not for the benefit of an admittedly guilty criminal. And a guilty criminal certainly has no vested right, Justice Gannage, in having immunity bestowed on.
But they have the right to be represented effectively by counsel, in which is, when immunity is conferred, they have a right to know about it.
And given,
they have that right, so they can make a decision whether or not to accept it, do they not?
And given all these competing policies, of course there is a policy that a lawyer should do his or her best in representing anyone in a civil or a criminal case. And given that you don't compensate criminals for the necessary consequences, inevitable consequences of their crime,
here it was not inevitable.
Sir?
Here, it was not inevitable. At the time the offer was made, she was offered, according to opposing counsel, complete transactional immunity forever on everything, and the crimes for which she ultimately entered a plea of guilty at that time were totally undiscovered, and yet they would have been covered by the immunity offer.
Well, she had a disappointed hope of escaping justice.
I'm wondering if she had not been represented by counsel at all and the United States attorney had made such an offer to her, what she would have done. I mean, that's pure speculation on my part. I'm sure she would have walked away from it, said, no, I'll take my chances.
Well, she might have.
Mr. Sloman, you argued for a rule in criminal defense malpractice that's different from a civil lawyer's malpractice. Can you amplify a little bit on the public policy considerations that you think we ought to take into account in making that distinction?
Well, we discussed those, Justice Cornyn, at length in our brief, but in a brief word, there are those that I have discussed here that in terms of causation or in terms of policy, a criminal should not be paid money by a lawyer who has failed to get a better deal or failed to call a witness or failed to convey immunity. And the criminal has avenues, if there are Sixth Amendment problems that are wholly different. But you, as a matter of policy and of legal causation, do not permit that person to be compensated. Now, as far as the lawyer is concerned, that policy may very well say, well, you're going to be suspended or disbarred from practice or something of that sort, or you're going to have to give the fees back. And that's another case that I'm not trying to articulate, but the overriding policy, for instance, as expressed in Shaw 2 at page 15 of our brief, and if I can, it's very short, we have held that civil recovery should not be a tool for shifting an individual's responsibility for the individual's criminal act. We hold that if plaintiffs engaged in the criminal conduct that they are accused of, then they alone should bear full responsibility for the consequences of their acts, including imprisonment. Any subsequent negligent conduct by a plaintiff's attorney is superseded by the greater culpability of the plaintiff's conduct. Now, that's an Anglo-American policy that's near universal. And it is just another example of a case where you have an overriding, paramount, and wise policy of not permitting prisoner lawsuits and having a bright line rule that you're never going to permit that person to be compensated because of the crime that they brought themselves into. And on the other hand, a lawyer does not, as it was suggested, walk free.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Waldner, if we treat criminal defense lawyer malpractice the same as we do civil lawyer malpractice, what are the prospects of these suits being filed en masse by current residents of the Texas Department of Corrections for whom the statute of limitations has not run?
I would think that first of all, again, with the Tiarina case, the Corpus Christi is the decision that was put in a brief, that there are courts of appeals in this state who consider that to be the law. The Peeler Court, the Dallas Court of Appeals, declined not to follow that. But that essentially has been the law in Texas up to this case in the Court of Appeals, and we haven't been overrun with these types of cases. Secondly, as an alternative decision, the more restrictive holding that I would propose for the court, when there is a plea at bar that is available to the criminal defense attorney, that would narrow it, as far as we can find in Texas jurisprudence, to Carroll Peeler. Because we can find no other case where there was double jeopardy, diplomatic immunity, transactional immunity, statute of limitations, those things that are absolute plea and bar.
That would overcome the causation issue, but it still would leave the public policy arguments for distinguishing between civil and criminal legal malpractice Mr. Sloman makes.
With regard to engrafting the innocence requirement on plaintiffs who sue criminal defense attorneys for legal malpractice, that's correct.
Counsel, but, is there any... should we consider exhaustion of remedies here? Some courts have alluded to that. The failure to appeal, to try to undo the plea bargain. I have not seen any mention of it in your briefs, but should we make a requirement that somebody to sue also start a process through the Texas disciplinary procedures?
Why I think that would be unfair is this, Chief Justice Phillips, that you're talking about taking a conviction that shouldn't have happened, that wouldn't have happened but for attorney misfeasance or malfeasance, and further burdening the client with that. In Carol Peeler's case, she filed a Section 2255 application in federal court to have her conviction overturned. It was dismissed because it was held that the constitutional right she had to counsel did not exist back in 1985 when she was just under investigation and had not been indicted. And that was upheld by the Fifth Circuit, and the application for it was denied by the United States Supreme Court because they said that her constitutional right to an attorney didn't exist because she was merely under investigation, and in essence, in the decision, have deferred to the state courts to handle this problem, and so here we are. But Mr. Sloman said that she had been convicted of tax fraud. That's not what she was convicted of. That's not what she pled guilty to. If you look at the Court of Appeals decision and the record, she pled guilty to aiding and assisting the filing of a false tax return by taking these documents that Congress retroactively made illegal in January when they made it retroactive to September 22nd, which was just before they had been done. And it wasn't tax fraud. It was that she provided documents to investors, they attached to their tax returns, and that deduction was disallowed because of the Technical Corrections Act of January 83, which backdated itself to effective date 2 days before she had made the transactions. And the last thing I'd like to point out is this, is that what is being suggested right here is that this court create a whole new class of men and women that heretofore has never existed in the state of Texas, that we give civil immunity to criminal defense lawyers that under the most egregious circumstances of not just attorney negligence, but of conscious attorney betrayal, that they have no accountability in our civil system. That does not exist for any other group of individuals in the state. If someone were driving while intoxicated in violation of the laws of the state of Texas and they hurt themselves and broke their leg, when the doctor who fixes the leg causes a further injury, we don't allow that doctor to avoid his or her responsibility for that professional negligence, because that arose out of the commission of a crime.
This cause of action is recognized in this case is remanded to the trial court for a jury decision. They indeed find that, Mr. Jordan is liable to Ms. Peeler for some damages or recompense of some sort. Will she be made whole?
She can never be made whole by any jury or any court because of what happened to her. She is, as the Court of Appeals stated in this decision, every case that you read that we cite starts out with client appeal, client appeal, clients brought legal malpractice case. Every one that we've cited, except the Peeler case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals that begins with the two words, convicted criminal brought legal malpractice action. That happened to her. It's never going to change. That she pled guilty on advice of the attorneys who had the immunity in their pocket. And a jury or court can never give back to her the fact that that occurred. That can never be changed. Her right to vote possibly may be restored someday. She'll never have a civil service job. She'll never work on jobs that have certain government contracts. None of that can ever be given back.
Your time has expired, so I'm sorry, try to keep your answers to the questions.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.